Then arriving at the breath, feeling the touch of air at the nostrils, with the movement of the belly. Let the breath be felt as something very intimate that you're very close to, connected. Both simple and mundane and precious. Vital. Can be helpful to make a soft mental note, in, out, or rising, falling, as you track the breath. That mental noting can be extended to tracking or noting whatever is arising, so that when you hear a sound, just noting hearing. When you realize you're lost in thought, noting thinking. You can label particular types of thoughts, like planning or remembering, or analyzing, any word that comes to mind when you're describing the thought or the experience. It's not something that has to be exactly accurate, but just a way of bringing more precision to your attention. Noting is a useful practice to explore if you find it helpful. If not, just staying with the breath or the more felt experience. working with effort. It's one of the challenging and key elements of meditation practice. How hard do we try? Perhaps more essential is, what is the nature of that trying, of that effort? Is it coming out of a frustration or striving? Or is it more detached, just a impersonal intention to deepen the awareness, to deepen our experience? When there's a sense of grasping, striving, or a sense that we're not doing it right, creates more disturbance in the mind. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't apply some effort and determination to be present. We just have to really tune into the subtle quality of that effort. To let go of the striving, and yet to really apply ourselves to being present. All right. It seems that my wife always needs to move the furniture when we're meditating, so I don't know how much that comes through the microphone, but I always have this tendency to want to say good morning, but recognizing that it might not be morning where you are, I'll just say hello or good day. So I I'm going to talk a little bit about how one breath at a time happened, because step eight, uses a couple of quotes from just very short lines or expressions from Bill Wilson's book, The 12 and 12, his commentary on the 12 steps. And so I was remembering that that when I started to think about this book, I would take this copy of the 12 and 12 on BART, which for those who don't know the Bay Area, is Bay Area Rapid Transit, our sort of subway, and not always below ground subway. I was working in San Francisco and living in Berkeley and Albany, and so I would take this and just read it and make notes in it. And as I was thinking that, because those phrases are in step eight in one breath at a time, I realized, well, I stopped that job in July of 2000, and I didn't start writing the book in a formal way until 2002, and it wasn't published till 2004. So it's interesting to me that it was like that I didn't realize, I guess, in a way, that I'd been preparing the book for all those years. But in step eight, what I would do is I would just read it and then try to think, oh, is there something Buddhist in here? And so in step eight, there's this line: calm, thoughtful reflection upon personal relations can deepen our insight. I was like, insight, great. We've got insight meditation right there. But it's such a meditative sentence. Calm, thoughtful reflection upon personal relations can deepen our insight. It also says, defective relations with other human beings have nearly always been the immediate cause of our woes, including our alcoholism. Defective relations with other human beings. Well, he likes that word, defect, apparently. But then later in that paragraph, if all of these are paginated in the same way, but if you have 12 and 12, this is on page 80 of the version I have. It says, we can go far beyond those things which were superficially wrong with us to see those flaws which were basic, flaws which sometimes were responsible for the whole pattern of our lives. Now that was that phrase, the whole pattern of our lives, is one that I took as a heading in step eight. And before I talk about that, something I thought of as I was reading that is that one of the emails I got today was from someone saying that that they're not alcoholic, that they're addicted to the internet and something else. I forget, maybe it was sex, but yeah. And so I just wanted to say, like, even though my primary addiction I identify really as alcohol and marijuana, but I certainly don't think of what I'm teaching or what this group is about, as being, you know, you have to identify as a particular type of addict, or even identify as an addict. You know, if you find it helpful to reflect on these ideas, everybody's welcome. And you know, the Buddhist teachings really point to the idea that all humans are, in some sense, addicted. I don't like to overplay that idea, but if clinging is the cause of suffering, of human suffering, and everybody suffers, then in some sense that we could say we all have similar challenges, whether we call them addictions or not. So, and in fact, that's been one of my wishes, is to reach a broader audience than just people who self-identify as addicts, because I do think that the teachings on Dharma and recovery, and, you know, are relevant for all people. I'll also say that, you know, as I was guiding the meditation, I was trying to, at a certain point, I was talking a little bit about effort and determination, and, you know, I tend, at this point, at least in my practice, towards the slack end of, or maybe that's the slacker end of the meditative effort. And, you know, early in my practice, I did a lot of striving, and it became so uncomfortable that I gave up. And then it turned out to be that worked. Giving up was a good way to meditate. But I also recognize that, you know, there's always this balance, and it's really the, I think the key to, and certainly to being comfortable and to getting calm and focused and concentrated in meditation is a balanced effort. So I had yesterday during my morning sit, I was towards the end of the sit, I started to make a little bit more determination. At the end of my sits, I do, I go through the five daily reflections. And I made more of an effort to kind of not just recite them. I'm of the nature to age, to sicken, and to die. I must be separated from everyone and everything that I hold dear. And then I'm born of my karma, heir to my karma, related to my karma, supported by my karma, the owner of my karma. Whatever karma I do, whether good or evil, this I will inherit. So easy to kind of, when you memorize it, to just kind of go through it, blah, 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 you know. Our Father who art in heaven, blah, 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 you know. So I stopped and kind of went through it, because it definitely gives you things to think deeply about, to what did Bill Wilson say, to have calm, thoughtful reflection upon. And I then, as I was doing it, I felt my mind getting very sharp and clear and focused, and my body kind of very grounded. And I was like, oh, this is helpful, because I was just like upping my effort just a little bit, but it wasn't like a striving. It was just like connecting more deeply with the experience of those words, with the meaning of those words, and exploring them a little bit. And I actually added something to it. The daily reflection, you know, the beginning of it's really about impermanence, of the nature to age, to sicken, and to die. And I realized that a lot of my experience of impermanence of my body right now isn't so much like aging in general, and not sickness, thankfully, and not death, but pain. I thought, oh, I should add pain in there. I'm of the nature to sicken and have pain. I have not gone beyond sickness and pain. I think that really, aging and sickness imply pain, but I find it helpful to be more specific. So I've added that. Anyway, this is just, my recommendation as to people who are meditating is to really notice what the nature of your effort is as you're meditating. And which means you have to be mindful of both your breath and the effort you're making to be with the breath. And that's kind of tricky. It takes a subtle kind of like looking around the corner or looking over your shoulder kind of to see what's happening, but experiment with that and see what helps. Notice if you're really trying hard, trying to do it right, and you're thinking, how do you do this? I'm getting it wrong, because that's the over-efforting, if I didn't indicate that. Or if you're just like, oh, everything's cool, like, wow, when you're not conking out, the snoring is usually a big indication. I have occasionally snorted when meditating. That's pre-snoring. All right. So, let me talk about this section of the book. That was the whole pattern of our lives. It is a great line and it does really suggest like the way our inventory and then the specific list. So I should go back because some people don't memorize the 12 steps. Step 8 says, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And so the idea that making this list might reveal the pattern of our lives, I think, is a really intriguing idea. And it was intriguing enough to me that I wrote a few pages on this idea. And so in the book, I talk about being on my first retreat, which, comes up a lot. And if you ever write a book about meditation, you'll probably find yourself writing a lot about your first retreat because they tend to make a big impact on us. But at the end of the retreat, we went through a loving kindness exercise in which we went through, as you do with loving kindness, these different categories of people: the people you love, people who are neutral to you, people who you have difficulty with. And what I realized in that, and which I also realized when I did my amends list, was that the people I loved and the people I were difficult were often the same people. And that, of course, provokes a question like, why is that? What seems apparent is that this is about intimacy. I may have even talked about this last week. I don't know. But it's one that really, stays with me and that I find compelling, that when we open ourselves up to people, we become more vulnerable. And again, maybe this is more for addicts, but I think it's a very human thing. And so there's more of a potential for conflict as well. And this is, I feel like I don't have to say if you've ever been in a relationship or if you've ever had an intimate connection, because this is our family members, right? This is our lovers. This is our best friends. It's easy to kind of get along with strangers, you know, and with casual acquaintances, everything's great, you know, very superficial. But when we go deeper with people, then we open ourselves up. And so, and we open ourselves both to love and to pain, to hurt, because we can't connect and feel that love without making ourselves vulnerable. And this is, you know, why people, of course, are afraid of intimacy, why people avoid intimacy. Understandable. And so this idea of the whole pattern of our lives then is, I mean, I guess I'm making an argument right now. I hadn't thought about it, but I'm making an argument that this is not a very unique pattern, that this particular pattern, that the ones we love are also the ones we'll find difficult, is kind of natural and human. But I think what we will see is who have we opened ourselves to? And then I guess conversely, who have we not opened ourselves to? Who have we not allowed to love us? Who have we not allowed ourselves to love that we might have? Or who has not allowed themselves to be loved? You know, who has not loved us? Who we wanted to love us? You know, AKA our parents. You know, if that was, you know, a thing, I don't know. So. I'm not sure what to do with that idea, with these ideas, except to kind of accept them, you know, to kind of see like this is the nature of being human. Maybe it's another daily contemplation, you know. If I wish to be loved, I must also allow for pain. And you know, which you know, there's a sutta that I wrote a chapter in my book Living Kindness about that points to this. It's called Born from Those Who Are Dear. And in this sutta, a sutta is what's called these are the early teachings, the earliest teachings that we have preserved of Buddhism. And a sutta just means like a discourse or a teaching. And in this sutta, Born from Those Who Are Dear, a man comes to the Buddha whose son has died, and he's in despair. And he's out of his mind, you know, with despair. And the Buddha, he can be tough, you know. You think of the Buddha as being this loving, compassionate being, but when he sees someone really lost in their delusion, or kind of going out of their mind, he kind of calls them out. And so he says, you know, he uses the phrase, come to your senses, first of all, which is an interesting phrase, like what that means. I think Jon Kabat-Zinn has a book with a title like that. And he's saying, like, you know, you're freaking out, like, take a breath, you know, come into your body, you know, come into your senses. But then he says, like, that you have to understand that suffering is born from those who are dear. And it's, I've never read an analysis of the Pali, but I suspect that this was a bit of a pun on, it is a play on words, because this person's son has died, which is the opposite of birth. And the Buddha says that your suffering is born from this person who has died. But, you know, he's pointing to this this fundamental truth, which is very difficult to accept, which is that when we love people, when we are attached to them, when we open ourselves to them, there's going to be some kind of suffering that happens. And the sutta goes on, and other characters come in, and the king and the queen are brought into this discussion, and the king is very skeptical. He's like, that doesn't make any sense, you know. The people I love are the ones who make me happy. And then they say, well, what if, you know, your son didn't behave the way you wanted him to? What if he left and wouldn't become the king, you know, which is of course what the Buddha did, you know, leaving his family. And the king realizes, oh yeah, if they don't do what I want them to do, or if something bad happened to them, I would be really sad. And so this idea, it's, you know, very typical Buddhist idea, and yet one that is very difficult to accept, that when we open ourselves up to love, we also open ourselves up to pain. And you could take that, as some people do, and even I think some Buddhists do, to mean, oh, you shouldn't have those kind of relationships. Like, oh, if you're a monk, then you're cutting yourself off from your family and you're not having intimate relationships. But guess what? You're a monk, you're living with other monks and you're in love with them. You know, it's like, there's no getting away from this. That's my view. I mean, I suspect there are other views about this teaching that, oh, we really should just be detached. But that's not how I view it. I don't think the Buddha is saying that. I think he's saying that our suffering comes from our misunderstanding, that when we understand the truth, when we have insight into the truth, when we remember we are of the nature to age, to sicken, and to die, isn't meant to cause you to be depressed. It's meant you to be free from confusion. And I think this is like key to understanding what the Buddha is teaching in terms of insight, that insight isn't about, oh, I got some transcendent wisdom and now I just live in bliss because I'm enlightened. Insight is rather, oh, I see reality. And so I'm not disturbed by it. I'm not agitated by it. I feel the fullness of sorrow. I feel the fullness of loss. And I feel the fullness of joy and love. But I'm not lost in them. I don't think that, oh, I've got to hold on to this love, or I've got to get rid of this pain. I just live in it. This is life. This is the fullness of life. And to me, that speaks very much to the life in recovery, because this is the same choice that we in recovery have made. As addicts, we were very much trying to restrict our experience of life to just the pleasant. We just wanted the good stuff. I just want the love. I don't want the pain that comes with intimacy. You know? So we kept ourselves in this chemically induced, mood. At least we tried. Of course, we failed, but that was what we were kind of striving to for. And then recovery and coming out of that, at first is this, oh God, like, here's all the shit, you know, now I've got to deal with life. It sucks, you know. But then after a while, as we recover, rather than just like get sober or get clean, as we come into recovery, that healing, we realize, oh, no, this is life. This is okay. I can be with this. And I think, you know, being in meetings and sharing that with people and hearing, you know, what's a AA meeting or any other recovery meeting, but a bunch of people talking about life. And when you hear people talk about life, when it's not your life, it's their life, and you realize, oh, this isn't about me, my suffering. This is what life is. Then we come into that acceptance. And in Buddhist terms, equanimity, which I think is the kind of Buddhist corollary to acceptance. So that to me is like, I guess I would call that, I think of it as spiritual maturity. I don't know. I don't know if I'm spiritually mature. I like to think so. But it's, you know, different from the magical thinking of enlightenment, and it's all going to be fun now. So I want to make sure I finish up this section of the book, because I don't want to keep going over it. Because there's a section at the end of this little, there's a couple paragraphs that I think are useful here that take us more into talking about meditation. And because I start to talk about forgiveness. And, you know, I begin by framing it in the need for forgiveness if you're in a long-term relationship, and indeed, we could just say in any kind of intimacy, right, with family, beloved, that we need intimacy. I mean, that we need forgiveness. So, when I catch myself with something like that, I'm afraid that, like, in a few years, I'm not going to notice that I said the wrong word. Like, anyway, aging. I am of the nature to age. So the last paragraph here then shifts back. Say, this quality of forgiving and beginning again is the same one we need in meditation. Each time we find that we have slipped from our awareness of the present moment into some memory or fantasy, some judgment or analysis, right then we need to forgive ourselves and start our practice right in that place. When we come out of the dream, that's when we have the opportunity to begin again fresh. Like marriage, our meditation practice is a long-term relationship. It has its ups and downs, its bliss and its misery. And like a relationship, it needs gentle nurturing and persistent effort. So one of the tricks of writing books like this, in case you're working on a book like this, is you always write like the, you know, you have a really forceful final paragraph of a section that's like, you know, evokes, makes people feel inspired and enlightened. So that was what that was. I shouldn't be telling you these tricks. It's all, you know, we're meant to, pulling the curtain back on Dharma teaching. So I'm going to open up. I see there are some comments here. The sutta number of that sutta. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. Let me see. The Majjhima Nikaya is across the room, but Living Kindness is here, so maybe it's in here. But if somebody wants to say something in the meantime, you can unmute yourself and ask a question or whatever.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Oh, it's Majjhima 87. Majjhima Nikaya 87. Okay. Who is that?
Yeah, Mike.
Oh, Mike. Hi. Nice to see you.
Hey. Good to see you. I liked your comment about meditation being like a marriage. The goods, the bads, the ups and downs. I can totally relate to that. So I kind of have an easy question, but you talked about noting during meditation.
Yeah.
And I was just listening to a Joseph Goldstein talk, and he was talking about noting per minute, and I'd never really heard that before. And I've kind of been trying it a little bit, and I just wondered, you know, kind of what you thought of it and if you had any advice on how to use it.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Mike. Yeah. I brought it up because because it is a way of making the attention more precise. And so the mechanics of it are that you start with the simple noting of the breath, you know, so that you're just noting in, out, if you're following the breath at the nostrils, or rising, falling, if you're following the breath at the belly. So you kind of got this, it's like having a mantra, but a mantra that's changing. It puts like kind of words in the mind that are there partly to block other thoughts, right? Stray thoughts, to kind of keep you on track. So you start with the breath, and then when you realize you're having a thought, like, oh, you know, like we have that moment, like remember, oh, wait, I'm thinking. You actually make a mental note of that. Now that initial note or noting can just be thinking. And for some reason, it's always taught to repeat the note, thinking, or hearing, you know, whatever the note is. I think that's meant to like interrupt, kind of like thinking, like not just like thinking, okay, go back to your thought, but kind of really interrupt the thought. And you can then do that around sound, hearing, or sensation, which, how do you notice sensation? It can be sensation, or feeling. I find like two syllable words are easier than longer words, to because the noting can become clumsy when you're sort of making these long, you know, long terms. But then with the thinking, you can make it more precise. So the first way to kind of up the noting on thinking is to notice whether you're having a thought of desire or a thought of aversion. So desire, aversion, you know, which requires you to kind of go, what was that thought? Was it a thought of desire? Was it a thought of aversion? Which can become a distraction in itself, right? You have to kind of be very careful that you're not going into like, what was I thinking? What kind of thought was that? You know, it's, if you don't like catch it right away, you just come back to the breath, right? Like if it's not obvious to you. But certain types of thoughts, like judging, is a really popular one to note, just because it's so common. But I get a lot of music in my head, and I'll just note song, because it's, is it a thought? I don't know. Is that a thought? Is hearing me, you know, and it's not hearing because it's not actually a sound. So you can see how it can turn into sort of like, what was that? You know, and you want to avoid that. But the point of it is just to say the same, repeat myself, but just to get back to that, is that it makes you start to really notice what's going on. So in terms of this section of One Breath at a Time, it helps you to see the pattern of your thoughts, right? The whole pattern of our lives, right? Well, the whole pattern of our lives is really created by the whole pattern of our thoughts, because our lives are created out of our thoughts. So you start to see, oh, I really tend to think about this stuff a lot. Like I obsess about money a lot, or I obsess about sex a lot, or I obsess about my past a lot, you know, and you start to see like, and so that can become really helpful, because you realize in your daily life, the same thing is going on. And so you can start to catch yourself more often in your life, as well as in your sittings. Like, oh, this is just a habit of my mind, you know, and to detach yourself from those habits, because we identify so much with them, and we make them into such a big deal, right? Like it's so important. Like I keep thinking about this, you know, but when you start to see them as just these imprinted patterns that just show up, they have less power over you. They're not as destructive, and they're easier to let go of. Yeah. So the problem with with noting where it can get to is that it can start to feel like a lot of work. Like you're kind of like I just want to sit here and meditate. Like I just want to sit here and kind of be present, you know, and be mindful and be in my body. And because it's a very mental way of meditating, first of all, because it's like verbal. And it can start like, it can be like, oh, did I miss one? You know, you start to get almost competitive or striving in it. So I found it got frustrating after a while. But I think it's a practice that everybody should do for a while until they can't stand it anymore, because it really is so revealing, you know, and it's a good habit to get into. So I don't do noting practice much anymore, but I've tend to be aware of my thoughts, of what they are, of the nature of my thoughts, both in meditation and in my daily life. Like, oh, there I go again is kind of the my mantra. It's like, oh, there I go again, you know, there it is again, you know. And that's a really helpful thing to just learn to let go of, to be more aware of thoughts and then learn to let go of them.
Yeah, I'm using it for something really basic, just like when I'm meditating, just when I start thinking, I just like ping thinking and just use it to interrupt myself. Yeah. But Joseph was talking about using it for mindfulness kind of all the time and getting your notation up all the time. And yeah, that sounds like it might drive me crazy after a while.
Yeah. You know, this was taught by Mahasi Sayadaw. I'm going to put his name in the chat, and it seems like that it was it came out of a Burmese lineage. I don't know if Mahasi was the originator of it, but it's when I first started to practice in 1980, it was very commonly taught. It's not nearly as commonly taught nowadays, Jack Kornfield's book, Living Dharma, has an interview with Mahasi Sayadaw, and he describes it. And if you read it, your head will spin. You know, you're like, what? No. Because it's like, yeah, every step you're taking, every time you reach out, reaching, you know, touching, sitting back, you know, that's instruction for when you're on a retreat. It's not, I don't believe it's meant to be like normal daily life instruction. I think that's what Joseph is talking about, but I don't know. Thanks. Yeah, thanks. Any other questions before we go here? I'm looking back to see if there's something else I can respond to in the text. So just to remind you that this Friday is a Spirit Rock night, and that class starts at 7:15 instead of 7 o'clock. And you have to go to the Spirit Rock website, and they ask you to pay to get in, but there's like an option to give zero, I believe. Is that right, Angela? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't mean that you shouldn't support Spirit Rock. If you can support Spirit Rock, please do. And in fact, when you pay, it helps to support me as well. However, don't let that, you know, keep you from showing up if money's an issue. What else? For those who are interested, yeah, I'm on the schedule with 10% Happier to do an interview on my book, Living Kindness. And I am actually, even though it's already available through Amazon, I'm talking to a publisher about actually making it a publishered book, yes. Because I think that might spread that book out further. But anyway, that's my news. I thank you all for showing up. Thank you for your continuing, Donna. Always appreciated. And I think that I don't have any other events. Let me just look at my calendar.
Napa Valley Insight on the 20th.
The 20th.
That's for a few weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a ways. Oh, I'll be at the Gay Buddhist Fellowship on April 11th, which is a Sunday morning, 10:30 a.m. Pacific time. I assume that is open. All right. Thank you all. And see you on Friday or sometime in the future. In the meantime, don't drink or use, no matter what. All right. And meditate every day.